Hey, this is Brett from We Talk Comics, and I am proud to bring you a special show with an extra special guest. Today I have the absolute honor of sitting down with the creator of Fables and the brains behind Fabletown and Beyond, Mr. Bill Willingham. Bill, how are you today?
I am great. Thank you very much, Brett, for having me, and it's nice to be sitting down with you as well. I mean, it looks like we're both old men, so sitting down is a good way to start anything of importance.
It is a great way. And one of the things that I want to say right off the bat is that Fables is, you know, this is just going to be my geek out moment. Fables is my absolute favorite comic book. I just don't think there's a better book out there. My wife loves it. I love it. You know, everybody we hand it off to loves it. And so I just want to thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for the compliment. One of the things I really like about Fables is, and we don't have the budget to do real market research and see, you know, how many people are reading these. But anecdotally, it seems like Fables is a throwback to the comics of old where any one issue can theoretically be handed off to many readers. It used to be that they estimated, 3 or 4 readers per comic sold. And then the collecting age of comics really changed that, where people would buy multiple copies, to preserve for value later. And so the estimated, readers per comic sold dropped way down into negative numbers, like 3 or 4 comics sold per actual reader. And it's been that way for a long time, and we've gotten out of that. The collecting mentality ebbs and wanes. But just anecdotally, I hear a lot that issues of Fables are handed off to other readers, and I love that. I love the fact that we look at our sales figures and think that our number of readers is probably more than number of issues sold. I wouldn't mind keeping that ratio for a long time to come.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, well, you know, I'm greedy. I want the money too. So, you know, I'm of two minds. But readers, much more important.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you were right in front of me right now, I would happily hand you $20.
Well, thanks. I'll send my people over.
That's actually one of the feelings I have about conventions. Is that I've said it before. Is that one of the reasons I love going to conventions is because when the creator is sitting there selling something right in front of me, I can just walk up to them and be like, I love your work. I'm going to buy something from you right now. And it just makes me feel a lot better.
Well, good. Yeah, I like that. I like the personal interchange with readers. This is a business that if you're going to be any good at it, you have to be comfortable with locking yourself alone in a room for long periods of time. And there can be months that go by, literally, not figuratively, where the average comic writer or artist never sees any indication that these things are not just being sent out to disappear. You know, this is my work and I'm sending it out, and they say something's happening with it. And I think that's the main reason I like to go to as many conventions as I can, is that just to get that visceral reminder that these things are getting out to people. There are actual human beings that see these and find value and enjoyment from them. I suspect one could easily go insane without that regular reminder that they're getting into people's hands.
Well, given the state of comic book stores right now, and this will segue into Fabletown and Beyond, are directed conventions like Fabletown and Beyond perhaps the new comic book store? And is this a good thing? Because I think a lot of what people, want is the ability to talk about their favorite comics, and that's what the comic store's being able to give.
Well, sure. In its short lifespan, and I say short in relationship to the movement of, you know, continents and glaciers and such, the comic store has become, in addition to being a store, a meeting room where people can get together and talk. And it's really in the good merchants' best interests, that they have a clientele that will talk amongst each other, because that's how one customer tells another customer of this wonderful new book that's now available. And so that's all in, any good comic store will have a kind of open, welcome, feel to it's a place that you can kind of hang around a bit and gab, in addition to, you know, making the transactions to buy comics. And I think, good conventions, fill much of the same role. Let's call a good convention, and I hope, Fable Town and Beyond becomes, is one, is successful. It's like the pre-comic store, where you can get people from not just your neighborhood, but from all around to come. And in our case, we're going to talk about a very specific type of comic. But the average reader might not realize that there are a whole lot of good books within that category of that very specific type of comic. And so, yeah, you can buy some from the artist right then and there, a book that you'd never heard about before. And then hopefully take that back and interact with your comic store or wherever it is you get your comics and, you know, continue that, that relationship of buying from your store. So hopefully the conventions will not undercut or replace the stores, but, you know, maybe boost them every once in a while. I would love that to be, an accurate representation of what happens. One of the reasons we're doing, what did you call it? Like a directed convention? That's a very good term.
Yeah, that's kind of the way I look at it, because there's so many larger conventions that do everything that this seems far more directed.
Right, right. And at the larger conventions, like San Diego in the prime example, it's wonderful. It's huge. It's vast, and everything that could possibly be falling within our interest ranges is probably represented there somewhere. But the disadvantage is that San Diego, no matter what you're seeing, no matter what you're doing, you're missing 100 other things. It's just impossible to take it all in any significant way. So yeah, this is a focus. This is a you know, a little corner of San Diego where you found a few tables that all seem to be kind of in the same general area of interest. And you can go and you can focus on them. But unlike San Diego, you don't have all of those other things calling at you all the time, all of that frustration and anxiety over, well, I'm spending too much time here and I'm missing a lot of stuff. And plus I had to swim like a salmon upstream through a sea of people to get to this little corner I discovered. We promise you at Fable Town and Beyond, getting to that wonderful little corner of the industry will not be quite as hard as getting to any specific place in San Diego. I'm picking on them, but there's a lot of shops like that, a lot of conventions like that. Intimate, small, lots of access to the guests. We are setting up programming, signings, and a special theme bar just to promote any attendee having as much access with the guests they want as they can, with the proviso that if you turn out to be a creepy stalker, why then we will. Kidding aside, one of the things I love about it is the lady that's actually running the convention for me. I'm hosting it. I'm sort of setting goals and philosophies, but she's doing the hard work of actually putting the convention on, and she is the director of adult corrections in Olmsted County, where this takes place. She runs the jail, and some of the people we will have working for her are big, tough sheriff's deputies and jail guards. So we're going to have the safest convention per capita in a long time. But you know, those funny creepy stalkers aside, if you want lots of access to your favorite writer, artists amongst our guest list, you're going to get it at that show, and we're rather proud of it. I mean, the entire thing is designed to maximize the kind of contact and discussion you can have with artists and writers.
Well, I got that really excited. Like when I saw this list, I mean, I thought Mark Buckingham first. That was awesome. You, and then I see Mouse Guard, which I love. I got a chance to talk to David Peterson in San Diego a few years back. I mean,
isn't he a great
guy? Awesome. Mice Templar, Monkey Brain Comics. I'm a huge fan of their stuff right now. And so I see this list, and I was just like, why can't it be right beside me? Because I'm not sure that I can get to Minnesota.
Well, and I guess that's a bargain we're trying to make with everyone, which is we'll build the show if you can find a way to get here. And our part is to make the best comic show possible. It's the first time. I'm sure we'll make mistakes, but I've been doing this for a lifetime. I've done many conventions, and like every other comic writer artist in history, I've said, "Boy, if I'm ever dumb enough to do a show, this is all the things I will do more of, and these are all the things I'll avoid doing." We always craft the perfect thing in our head. The perfect thing in our head never quite translates to reality, but we're going to get as close as we can. So we're going to build a good show. I hope you and other people that are listening to this will consider finding a way to get here for it, because it's going to be pretty special.
Well, I would absolutely tell anybody to try to make it, because I know that they're going to find some great books there.
Yeah, great books, great conversations, and we're going to try and bring back a discussion of the state of the industry as a whole. The unfortunate thing with comics being so successful now, so well accepted by, the Hollywood community, the book community, the libraries, things like that, is that the programming time for most conventions gets burned up pretty quickly by publishers and movie producers and TV producers and game company producers trying to get word out about these are the things coming up. And that's a very legitimate thing to do at a convention. You want to get the word out to the core of the core of your core audience, because they're the ones that are going to talk it up and spread the word wide and far. But unfortunately, because there's only so many rooms and so many programming hours, that tends to suffocate what used to be the standard in comic shows, which is discussions about stuff, about where our industry is going, where it should be going, what's good, what's bad in it. When a publisher is flogging its wares, it's not going to have a frank discussion of here's our books that are great and here's our books that suck. You can't expect that from. So we're going to try and rein this in and bring it back to a nice discussion of the state of the industry. Part of our rules for that, of course, is we've narrowed the field. It's mythic fiction and books like that. Another way we've narrowed the field is we are not anti-publisher, but we're not going to have publishers doing panels of, this is our product line, please buy it. We're not going to have TV shows and things like that. Of course, we're not big enough to even catch their eye if we wanted to, but as a result, your programming or hours is going to be about stuff, about stories, about how to tell stories and what are good stories and what are bad ones and how we can move towards the good and leave some of the less than grand stuff behind. And I think that's something we're ready for again in our comic conventions.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that, because even noticing Grant Morrison's con, I think we're starting to see that little push towards the more intimate comic-related cons.
And I think it's time for that. We now have general comics conventions. Even the small ones are getting big because people want this now. Emerald City, I think, is one of the great comic conventions out there. And they started small, and for the last few years, they've had more people show up than their facility will allow, and they've had to upgrade their facility every single year for a few years and is doing it again this year. And that's a great sign that these people want to be out involved in this stuff. So that we've got these big general conventions, the next logical step is to say, let's have smaller conventions with a focus on something more specific, and we don't need those 30,000 people. We can peel off a few hundred or a thousand or so and say, let's get together and do this. With the proviso that there's always those other conventions that, we will make no one sign a pledge that now that they're doing our convention, they won't show up anywhere else. Have both. Wallow in as much of this as you want.
Yeah, we're in the same boat here because I live in Calgary, Alberta, and we have the Calgary Comic and Game or an Entertainment Expo, and that's what happened this year was there was people that were turned away because it was just too many people inside.
And you guys put on a good show. I love the show. I was up there a few years ago. I'm going to say 3 years ago, or was it two?
I think it was the year that I actually missed because my son was being born. So that.
Well, congratulations, and I'm sorry. I mean, not that your son was born, but that you missed. It was a year that who was the big guest? I'm terrible with names. You know the actress that played the evil Cylon in Battlestar Galactica, the evil seductress Cylon.
Yes.
It was the year she was a guest, and boy was that tough sharing a room. With her.
I can only imagine.
Calgary was a great, great show. And that's a perfect example of the kind of show where, those things, there's no reason they should get to be big shows because, you know, they're off in little corners of the world that you wouldn't imagine people would go out of their way to get to, and yet they are. There's a hunger for this kind of stuff. And I'm all for that.
Well, I certainly hope that you come back.
I'd like to. Every few years, we try and mix it up where I go to in any given year. But every few years, I'd like to get back. I'm getting back to Emerald City next year, so
nice. Well,
maybe I'll. Yeah, and then that, you know, and I love the community sense that the people that run the Calgary show help out with Emerald City and vice versa. And I just think that's great that each of you travel to each other's shows to help, you know, all those roles, all that work that needs to be done by basically volunteers, people that love the business.
No, it is. It's awesome. So was there a point where you were ever worried about Fables lasting?
Oh, yeah. Let's change that question a bit.
Okay.
It's not, was there a point, every day, I have been in this business long enough to know that sometimes you get a little bit of success and you can't count on it because tastes change or your readers, you become a victim of your own success when your readers are going, this is great. This was a wonderful story. I'm done. You know, I'm going to move on to other, I'm going to go looking and exploring at other stuff because, part of being an avid reader is that kind of sense of exploration and adventure to go find new good things. So I expect every single issue, the entire readership, to kind of collectively wake up and say, great, we're done. I've got enough of talking ducks and moo cows in my life. I'm moving on. And I hope that doesn't change with me. You know, I hope I don't get complacent and say, okay, these guys are mine for life and I can just phone it in. I think that struggle to earn your readership every single issue is a very real thing and is a good thing because as long as you're aware of that, every issue of Fables has to be the best I'm capable of writing under – you know, the current deadlines and conditions and what have you. And if it's not, it won't last. Plus, I've had so many books and ideas and series that would sometimes garner a little bit of critical praise, but sell in the dozens. I mean, they just, they just landed with Thuds out there. So it surprises me every time that that people are willing to read Fables. Of all the people that have congratulated me on the success of it, I will never be one of them because I just I don't believe it. I still think that maybe Fables will catch on someday if I keep at it.
I'm hoping for you to bring back Coventry.
Coventry is nice. It's a very work intensive thing. The deal with Coventry is I was drawing it and writing it myself. And I can write a few books a month and do things like novels and side projects. If I draw a book, I can barely get a book a month done, which means were I to bring back Coventry, that would be the only thing I would be allowed to do. With that in mind, the other option, of course, is bring back Coventry but get another artist. And that's, you know, I don't want to say it's an impossibility, but my fondness for those three scrappy issues of Coventry is such that I would be reluctant to just turn over the bulk of the storytelling, which is what the art is, to someone else. We'll see. The nice thing about Coventry is many of the themes and kind of odd outlooks on life that were part of Coventry and were going to be part of Coventry. Many of those have made it into Fables or other projects. As a matter of fact, the Fallen Angel plot line that was started in Coventry was made into its own self-contained story in Vertigo's A Flight of Angels, which was a I contributed a short story to a collection of short stories about angels. And that, I think, is still available hardback. So you can get little bits of Coventry-like stuff here and there if you are clever and attentive.
Yeah, that was actually probably my first real time that I took notice of you as a creator was Coventry. I loved it.
Well, thank you.
So did you have a story that you wanted to tell no matter what and that you were just kind of like focused on getting that one story out?
In Coventry?
Probably Fables more so.
In Fables, there's a few stories. As you may begin to suspect, Fables is not so much a strict series about something or someone as an ensemble series. It's a world setting. And it's a set of rules on how this bizarre fictional world works. And within that, so it's a setting. And within that setting, I have several stories that I want to tell and several stories that I had wanted to tell and we've gotten told. We're just wrapping up Cubs in Toyland, for example. And even though I didn't know years ago that it would be the sons and daughters of Bigby, Wolf, and Snow White that fell prey to this terrible interpretation of Toyland. That grim and horrifying interpretation of Toyland has been with me for a long time, and I have wanted to do that for some time. And part of it is just being patient until, you know, stories have to take their turn. We only have one issue a month, which when you look back over 10 years seems a lot, but, you know, one 20-page segment a month is a narrow window in which to tell all the stories that you're dying to tell. So as a result, there are many, many in the queue that are just going to have to wait their turn. But yes, I have a burning – there are many specific stories and many types of stories I want to tell. With Cubs, I wanted to do the Fisher King legend, but a new twist on it. With Fables, I got to do a whodunit detective story with the clues actually there for the reader to figure out if she was able. I've done political stuff. I've done war. I've had people acting like cads and people acting like heroes. And possibly my favorite, which is the guy you thought was a cad, finally finding that there is this bedrock of something inside that he can step up and be heroic. Just maybe, you know, not for more than a few days at a time. So yeah, I've told many stories I've been dying to tell with Fables, and there are many more that I hope we can get to.
So is this series, how far ahead planned out is the series?
It varies. Really locked in, like with actual lines of dialogue written and characters chosen and, you know, we can't do anything else with this character because he or she is needed for this. Locked in plots about 2 years in advance. Another 2 years out of that, we have general ideas, like eventually this is going to happen. Eventually this thing is going to come due. This thing that we seeded way back 6 years ago is finally going to come to bite someone on the ass. Let's see. There was a couple of things that were, you know, as much of as 6 year. Well, we've been doing Fables for, all right, let me give you an example. Pardon me for not finishing one sentence before I go to the next.
But you digress.
We've been doing Fables for 10 years. And, in the next two issues, we finally reveal, something, in this case, the, not quite the origin, but the origin, I guess, of the business office, this magical big place in a small place that I've been aware of all this time. But finally now is the right time to reveal something about it because it helps move a particular story along. So there's some of these things we seed way, way in advance. The Forsworn Knight, for example, had just been hanging around from that tree for a couple of years until we got to the Good Prince story arc, and then I could reveal that it had been Lancelot all along who had committed suicide because he, you know, broke all of his knightly vows way back when. I love seeding that early stuff to get to later. That's the kind of thing that I'm struggling with short stories, and one of the reasons we do so many short fable stories lately, like little three pagers and stuff, is I'm trying to train myself how to do quick stories. Because my real love are these long, long things that just take forever to play out.
That's one of the reasons that I like Fable so much, is because it's just that moment where when you first start reading Fables, like, I noticed that Boy Blue was just a character. By the time his story arc comes to full fruition, he was an amazing character. And that just blew me away.
Yeah, Boy Blue, that was a surprising one. That was almost unplanned for. In the sense that I knew at some point someone would go to the homelands and reveal the secret of who the adversary was. I mean, that was locked in early on. I didn't know it was going to be Boy Blue. Boy Blue was created specifically. Well, he wasn't created. He's a character from the nursery rhyme. But it was a small, silly nursery rhyme, and so I thought I had a small, silly character to fill that role. And his only job initially was I thought a lot more scenes would take place with Snow White in the business office, so we needed someone for her to talk to. Otherwise, she's talking to herself, and she's a little bit dotty. So that was his role. Boy Blue, assistant to Snow White, someone for her to talk to and complain to and et cetera, et cetera. But characters always raise questions, and in Boy Blue's case, just to tie in with the nursery rhyme, well, of course he plays the horn because the nursery rhyme says, come blow your horn. So he's a horn player. His name is Blue, so he plays the blues. I mean, that seems obvious. But by that time, the infection had set in, because then the normal question is, well, why does he play the blues? People who really play the blues well had a hard life. Those, you can tell a blues player that it's like, oh, there's something not there. And then later on, you find out that, well, he was raised in a loving, wonderful home, and everything was terrific, and dad made good money, and he never suffered. It's like, yeah, okay, that's why. You can't quite play the blues without them. So what was his suffering? Which gave us the last Castle story, wherein we found out that Boy Blue the best suffering in the world is a lost love. And even better than that is a lost love where there's that irony of she came back for him, he came back for her. They both decided to live for each other and ended up, because of that, being separated forever. So in order to make that story work, he had to be kind of a heroic figure. And he was a military figure from back when. And then his role expanded. Now he's not just the office guy. He's the guy that wants to just be an office guy because he realizes that the heroic action adventure life is tough. It has a lot of sacrifice to have that life. He's the guy that wants to be an office clerk but keeps getting dragged into adventure. And that was that made him perfect for the Homelands story. That is the one case of a character sort of growing to fill an empty niche that was there, even though we didn't necessarily have those plans for him. The other shot of that, the other side of that is Flycatcher, the Good Prince story arc, where that was planned in advance, and I was kind of holding on to that for a long time, waiting until the right time to put him through all that.
Oh, that's awesome. So are you cognizant of writing for trade paperbacks, or do you write for single issues and just kind of let it all come out?
Both. By the time we started Fables, the notion of longer arcs collected into trade paperbacks was pretty firmly established, and there was indications from DC that they planned to keep Fables in print at all times in trade paperback form. So I did write a lot to the trade paperback and do. I think they're probably better reads than that. But that said, I want to try and make sure that something significant and important happens in every issue. Sometimes the reader's mind is like, you know, they say nothing much happened in this issue. But then when they look back at the story as a whole, they realize that this little thing that they did not think was significant turned out to be dire in its implications. And then with stuff like the Burning Questions stories that were kind of played just for jokes or just to do short type stuff and things like that, that we do write for single issues. One of the deals with Vertigo in advance was each story will be the length it needs to be. We won't pad, and I don't want to do a lot of cutting to make it fit a specific thing. There was, you know, we tested that. There was a little pressure. Vertigo kept asking me during the Good Prince, is like, are we getting to it? Are we getting there? Because this has been going, this one story has been going on a pretty long time. Yeah, you don't want things to drag out too much. But one of my favorite Fable stories of all time, Rodney and June, where it's the two puppets that want to become human. There was really no reason to ever make it more than a two-issue story, and that was just exactly the right length for it. It was hopefully poignant, and we got, you know, the romance and the desire to be human, and then the realization that sometimes when you get what you want, it's not as good as you want, all in just two short issues, and everything in between. So the story is whatever length the story needs to be. And then sometimes we've had, you know, Scott Nybakken, who does the collected editions. I'm certain I've given him some gray hairs. I'm trying to figure out how we can get this epic, this huge epic, into a single collection. Or here's a story that isn't enough for a collection. So, okay, we're going to have to add this and this and this. And, you know, but that's for him to figure out. That's why they pay him the big bucks.
So how does the relationship get developed with you to allow you to let someone else write the characters, like Matt Sturgis?
It's either a suicidal impulse on my part or a lot of trust. It really is a lot of trust. I'm fairly protective about this fictional universe. So part of it is the writer comes first in the sense of, ooh, here's a guy who's writing I like, a great writer. Of course, he can play in the Fables universe because I just trust the stories that he tells. And I want writers to write Fable stories because I would love to be surprised by these things. The worst part about doing Fables is I kind of know what's happening next. Not often surprised. Matt, for example, when he did just the one-shot Lamia for Ferrest, what a lovely story, and a story I don't think I could have written. So how terrific is that? Chris Robertson with the Cinderella stuff. It's just delightful. So pick writers I already admire and want to see stories from. Then find out if they have fable stories in them. And some of the writers I admire that love fables that I've approached, it's like, yeah, this is great, but no, I don't have a fable story in me. And then avoid writers that are kind of imposed on it. There's been a couple of times when I've been asked by Vertigo editors, like, can so-and-so write a fable story? And I'm all for getting writers lots of work. But, you know, that particular person, I wasn't as familiar with his or her work as I should be to make that decision. I said, yeah, I don't know yet. Come back to me, you know. So, yeah, it's a tough thing to do to turn it over. And the only thing that allows me to do it is that I only turn it over to those whom I consider to be just wonderful writers.
Is that the same, basically, then, the way you choose artists to work on the book? I mean, I know Mark Buckingham does most of the work for the series, but... Or did a lot of the work.
Yeah. For better or worse, Fables is popular with artists and writers, so that those that are interested in doing Fables, we have our a pick of some just very wonderfully talented people. And certainly, I mean, why would you purposely pick an artist you don't think is very good? And sometimes the results are extraordinary. I mean, Mark Buckingham, I think the greatest gift I've gotten in my career is that he enjoys doing this work because, I expected him to, do an arc and go on to other stuff. But he fell in love with Fables and wanted to be the regular artist. And I thought that was great. Mark is just one of the most talented, comic artist ever. He first came to my notice. I mean, I've sort of seen his work, but the Comics Journal ran a piece some time ago titled "The Greatest Artist Nobody Knows," and it was about Mark Buckingham. And he was an artistic chameleon in comic book. His storytelling was always top notch. But like, he was the guy called in when Chris Bacallo could not finish the Death miniseries to finish it up. And no one noticed the change because he's like, I'm going to finish this in Chris Bacallo's style. And he is, he's a chameleon like that, and he can draw in 100 different styles, with equal dexterity. So when, Shelley Bond suggested him as an artist for, single Sandman related thing we were doing called Mer Pumpkinhead Agent of Shield or Agent of Dream, sorry. I leapt at the fact, like, oh yeah, he's the greatest artist nobody knows. Of course, let him give a shot at it. And since it was this big, sprawling, just ridiculous farcical epic, he drew this big, sprawling, ridiculous farcical epic exactly as it needed to be. And that was what cemented I was going to be a fan of his forever. So, of course, he was near the top of the list. When we were making a master list of who could possibly draw Fables arcs, he was right at the top and decided to stick around. Nowadays, I'm not entirely sure Fables could survive his departure. if he decided to go on to something else.
Is there anyone that you still want to work with? I mean, I know you were very lucky to get Adam Hughes.
Lots of people. I am proud of the fact that at a time when Adam Hughes, for example, is so busy that that getting interior work for him was just an iffy proposition. But it happened to fall, and he does these wonderful covers and could do them forever. And you have to understand, on just a practical account, what a pay cut he takes if he does interiors, because he does these wonderful covers and he gets the top rates for the, doing those. And then he has these art collectors that are ready with the giant checkbooks to buy that art. What he recoups from a cover is vastly far and away what he could do for interior pages. So he takes a big pay cut whenever he does interiors, but he loves the form and wants to do them. And it was very fortunate that he was gearing up, although we didn't know it at the time, for his run on the Dr. Manhattan series. So he wanted to get, you know, that ability to do interior pages back in action. You can have the abilities, but if you let them lie fallow for too long, they shut down. So he wanted to get back into that. And so we were very fortunate to offer him a little three-page story just at the time that he needed a little three-page story to get back in that particular saddle. And he did that wonderful job for the Porcupine character. Exactly the kind of story that Adam should draw. It was terrific. I am oft blessed by the confluence of chance and intention. To get some of these wonderful artists doing something. Gene Paul is doing a two-issue for us that is just gorgeous, that I just think is like, how lucky am I to be able to get these guys doing this stuff. Did I answer your questions in there somewhere?
Pretty much, yep. So
good.
One thing I want to know is, because you've been working in the industry for a couple of 3 years, and how has the creator-owned work changed over the years?
Well, I think, I gave Paul Levitz a line, for a big DC party, once, not realizing I was giving him a line for a speech he had to give at the party. We were just talking and I liken the state of the art of the comics industry is the opening of A Tale of Two Cities. It's the best of times. It's the worst of times. As a general level of number of people in the world to number of books we sell, comics has never been worse off. I mean, comics used to be ubiquitous, that everyone had comics in their life, or at least knew someone that had comics in their life. And now it's really a niche readership. But at the same time, that the sales are as low as they've ever been in a general way, comics has never been so accepted into the culture. Librarians used to sneer that, you know, comics will never be in libraries. And they said that with full intent, thinking it would never happen. And now they're not only in libraries, but they're the darling princesses of libraries, because the coin of the realm in a library is circulation figures, and comics circulate. They just get checked out a lot. So now they're beloved. Hollywood has embraced comics. Nowadays, there's as many stories of the scrappy young Hollywood writer-director trying to break in, using that as a way to get into comics someday, as there are, like, you know, people getting into comics hoping to make it big in Hollywood someday. That door is going both ways now. And it's just a great time to be in comics, and there's just so many kinds. One of the reasons we have this whole mythic fiction movement is that it is a real movement in comics. There's a giant block of books that are all in this one little kind of esoteric corner of our genres. In a medium that was so dominated by superheroes for 50 years that you didn't really, with very few exceptions, get anything but that. So yeah, it's the best of times. I mean, you can do comics about anything now and find enough of a readership to get by. And it's the worst of times in the sense that sales generally are down. That said, there's a whole bunch of people making a living off this, and I'm glad there's a readership out there that's hungry for good stories in any medium. So we just have to find ways to get to them. And I think in the long run, after we become trendy, I mean, we're trendy right now, but hopefully we'll leave a bedrock of, okay, now it's just an accepted medium. We can go get our stories in comics or movies or what have you, without any fear of this being considered an infantile method of story delivery. Yeah. Once again, did I answer the question or address it in some way?
Yeah, pretty much. I actually wound up reading a book on Comic-Con and the business of pop culture. It's quite an interesting book with a lot of different philosophies towards how the business can go. And so as you were talking there, it definitely reminded me of some of those elements.
Sure. There's lots of ways to get comics in a reader's hand right now. You do not, you can still go through a big company, and there's several advantages to doing that, but you don't have to. And I think the greatest boost for creator ownership is that there's advantages to creator ownership now. You can, if you want to work for yourself and work hard, get enough of a readership to where you don't have to release your properties to someone else's ownership and control. I think that's a wonderful thing. The gatekeepers are going away. The mechanisms for stopping someone from getting his stories out are going away. And I think that's a fine thing. Like always, the cream will rise to the crop. The good stuff will eventually find a readership, and the Sturgeon's Law of 90% of everything is crap will find its, you know, place too. And be picked up or ignored depending on how they do with their attempts to get a readership.
So how does the creator-owned element work with Fables? Because, I mean, most of these characters are of course from Fables. So do you own how do you own the characters in this case?
That's a good question. These are public domain characters. And this is one of the reasons I love working with them is because public domain characters are owned by everybody. They are not owned collectively. It doesn't mean that since the Big Bad Wolf is owned by everyone in the world that we have to get together and have a big election on, you know, what do we do with this character in the next issue? They're owned individually 100% by everyone, which seems a paradox, but it's not. Anyone who wants to can do whatever they want with that character, and that's part of the reason for doing Fables. What I own is my interpretation of those characters. You know, in the original stories, the Big Bad Wolf was not a detective in a small hidden community smoking like a fiend to dull his own senses and half in love with Snow White and then fully in love once he admitted it to himself. I mean, that's an interpretation of the Big Bad Wolf that that's fairly unique. So that's the part that's protected. My version of Snow White versus like Disney's version of Snow White, which they can be very protective of. But the core bedrock concept of Snow White, the original story, yeah, that belongs to anyone who wants it. Well, it belongs to you whether you want it or not. Just, you know, your choice, you, every single human being in the universe, now and ever after, it's your choice on whether to exploit that in any way. But it's yours, and have fun with it. The public domain guarantees that everyone is born rich, at least in one sense, because we all own this vast storehouse of just wonderful stories. And if you're clever enough, lucky enough, and really apply yourself, you can turn that into, you know, actual riches as opposed to potential.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. So a while back in your career, you wrote Ironwood, an adult-oriented comic.
Yep.
Now, what do you think of something like Howard Chaykin's Black Kiss right now?
Well, I haven't seen the new one, and thank you for reminding me of that, because I just heard about it and then went to Comixology to get it or someplace and found out that I was a little premature in my in the release dates. So and then I forgot. So now I remember. How much of it is out yet?
I believe two issues are out or working on the third. Now, it's tough because the only way that I can see it, per se, is either ordering it online or the review copies that I get, because we can't even get it across the border in Canada.
That dirty?
Yeah, that dirty.
He did the first Black Kiss, and I thought that was a very good experiment in doing the kind of story that is just only Howard Chaykin could do. It is that first Black Kiss that inspired other companies like Fantagraphics to start the Eros line and say, well, if he's kind of legitimized dirty books like that, then we can do them too. With Ironwood, it was my experiments. Like, I was wondering, well, I wonder if I have a dirty book in me. And the truth of the matter is, I think Ironwood was probably more of a failure than a success. When doing a 11 issue series that has a story that begins and ends, and where you're obligated to get to the end of that story, you're also obligated. There's that implied contract with the reader to get some nasty business in every issue. And I found that after about three issues of that, I was done. I was like, that's all I can think of. I want to tell the rest of the story, but the rest is kind of like, you know, kind of embarrassing and boring. I got it out of my system. The problem is those 11 issues still needed to be finished. So you'll find that as the story winds on, the dirty business that happens in any given issue, is stuff that couldn't actually occur. It involves, you know, centaurs and hydras and, you know, the most impossible sorts of things that it's like, yeah, that doesn't actually happen. But, you know, it ticks off that little thing in the box. It's like, well, we got someone naked here doing nasty stuff. Let's continue with the story. Yeah, it was an interesting experiment. I kind of liked the story in Ironwood, and, the rest is a little iffy to me. But at the same time, I suppose I needed to get it out of my system.
Yeah, it's interesting because I thought of those things when I noticed that you were in the sex in fantasy and sci-fi panel at the Worldcon, I think it was.
Yeah. And that was fun. I don't you know, I remember almost nothing I said for that other than, you know, answering specific moderator questions or something. Anyway, yeah, I was there. Apparently I'm qualified.
So what do you think of the movement towards digital comics?
I'm all for it. I think people are making the analogy of the buggy whip industry about how, look, good people were making buggy whips, but the industry was dead the moment the motor car came along. And I don't think that's a totally apt analogy, because comic book, printed books are not buggy whips. Printed books in one form or another have survived all kinds of technological advantages. We survived TV, and there was no real reason we should have. We survived movies. We survived, the computer age, et cetera, et cetera. We will always want physical comic books. When those go away, they'll go away for a while perhaps, but then someone will remember how cool and fun they are and how inexpensive they are now that no one's buying paper anymore, and bring them back. At the same time, having them digitally available, I think is an absolute boon, especially now that we've got the devices to read them in a reasonable way. I have on my iPad every single issue of Fables, Ferris, Jack, and as much of my body of work as has gotten processed digitally so far. The reason being that in one place, when I need to look up something for a future story, like at what issue did so-and-so first arrive, or what was it that so-and-so said back in issues, something that I need to call back, I can look it up. It's right there by my writing desk at all times, and I can look it up easily. I don't have that 3-hour search through all the back issues of Fables, etc., to find that one little quote that I need. So on a practical level, it's great. It's a great writer's help. At the same time, if that was the only place that I had my copies of everything I've done, at some point I'd drop it, or there would be a glitch, or the internet collapses because, you know, the overall collapse of humanity has come. I'd still have the books. I still have the books, and I can have all of that as well. I think one goes well as a companion for another. And the other thing is, people that have their own story, they're dying to get out, that can either work with an artist, or he is an artist, or work with a writer because he's the artist, can get it out and find a place to have the potential to find a readership without making that huge deal with the mega company, you know, to sign over the rights to the new Superman, not realizing what a phenom it's going to eventually be. It provides us options. I think anything that provides us a choice, a selection, is good. The brick and mortar stores, I think they're going to have to look to the future as to, like, what kind of store we have, and how can we make ourselves still viable in a digital age. But the one thing they shouldn't do is assume that because digital comics have come along that printed comics are going away. I don't think they ever will.
Yeah, Kickstarter's been great for that as well. It's given us a lot of options to help support the creators and new creators as well.
Isn't Kickstarter great? It's exactly what I'm going to enter the dubious area of politics right now. It may be or maybe not well known that I'm from the conservative side of the political fence. And one of the things we wail and whine about is things like our taxes taken away to support the arts. Even if you support the arts, meaning you think arts are important, you know, extracting money by force from someone who will never see, you know, piss Christ or what have you, is the wrong way to go. That's my belief, my philosophy. One of the things that that's thrown away is, like, well, if we don't do that, how else can this happen when the artist doesn't have the money on his own? Kickstarter is a perfect example. Kickstarter is voluntary taxes. I have a project. I want some funding for it. You're not investing. You're not in the sense of you're not buying stock in this and that will pay dividends someday. You're donating your money because you think this is a good idea and it should be out there. And sure, there's some incentives. There's some little gifts and thank yous and stuff like that. For donating the money, but not commensurate. You know, you donate more than you get back in gifts. Otherwise, they're not actually making anything for the project. It is voluntary taxes to say, yes, I believe this project should exist. I'm going to support it. And this project over here, where a guy's, you know, thrown something in a urine, and I don't think that's good. I get to vote no on that just by, well, I'm not going to fund that. I'm going to fund this thing I like. Everyone wins. Everyone gets the constituency and the support of the people that think that their project should go forward. I'm all for it. Granted, people are going to game the system. I've heard stories of, you know, my project is some nebulous thing that is obviously just a scam for just send me your money. That's always going to happen. I don't think people are going to be able to game the system as much as what would happen if we just extracted by force money from everyone and promoted or underwrote projects that one guy's nonsense is another guy's, oh, this is an important work of art. So I'm all for it. Kickstarter.
Brilliant. So when it comes to reviews, what do you think of creators getting tweeted negative reviews, or at least you know, their names put on the negative reviews by the reviewers? Because I noticed that Matt Sturgis retweeted a link to the Amazon review of the last Jack of Fables trade paperback, which the reviews were quite, you know, negative overall. And I thought that was awesome. Like, way to stand up for just yourself.
Yeah, sometimes calling attention to a bad review is the best way to rebuke it. I have an odd philosophy where reviews are concerned. You know the old adage, the truism, that you should never pay attention to your reviews because if you believe the good ones, you have to believe the bad ones too. I don't believe that's the case. I have got a perfectly sound way to accept, embrace the good reviews and dismiss the bad ones. And that's if they fall into certain categories. Reviews, first of all, reviews is a slippery term. It's interchangeable or it's used interchangeably with criticism, critiques. But they're really two different animals. Criticism, literary criticism, movie criticism, etc., is an act of scholarship. You're examining for, at least by the best lights that you can bring to bear, the overall betterment of the knowledge of human beings. Reviews is an act of consumer protection. It is Ralph Nader saying, this car doesn't work, don't buy it. Or this car does. This is where your best dollar, car buying dollar goes. Reviews of literary works are saying, this story is bad, this is why. Or this story is good, this is why. They're very similar in process, but very different in intent. But let's concentrate on reviews. Reviewing used to have fairly decent standards in the sense that to be a professional reviewer, you need to do certain things. You need to give a comprehensive look at the story and then say within that context, this is why it's good, bad, or a little bit of each. So many reviews, so-called reviews, now that anyone can do it, and that they have not the training or at least the discipline to do it, is just, I didn't like this comic, or I wanted Wolverine to be the kick ass here and he didn't, therefore it's, you know, bad. Very few critical standards being brought to bear. Any of those you should dismiss out of hand. If someone simply dismisses it and says, I don't like it, especially because it's not, they review the book they wanted to see rather than the book they did. You know, it's like, not did this story work on its own merits, did it succeed in doing what it wanted to do, but they simply say, I didn't like what they did with this. It's a bad book. Perfectly legitimate statement to make, but it's not a review, and you can just dismiss it out of hand. The nice thing about good reviews, and maybe it's the same writer, the same person bringing the same critical faculties or lack of them to bear, in a good review, you tend to say why you didn't like it or did like it. You say, I like this because this, this, and this happened. On a good review, you're usually giving, if you're not a trained reviewer, you're usually giving more context and more information to the reader than you do in bad reviews, because bad reviews are simply dismissive. Or they argue the wrong thing. They argue, you know, I wanted it to be this, and then they review the book they should have read. That's why you can dismiss one and accept the other. So I now give permission to all you people to just accept and embrace your good reviews and dismiss the bad ones. Now, occasionally there's bad reviews with someone who still does have the training or at least the frame of mind to give a totally in-context review. And that's another kettle of fish, but unfortunately becoming so rare now that we can almost, you know, not talk about that as part of an answer to your question.
Yeah, like I do write reviews for the Comicosity website, and as I'm doing them, I try very hard to to give it in context, because I don't want to just be that random internet troll who's just going out there and saying, this book sucks, so there.
Yep. I can look at something like Watchmen and pan it to a certain extent, the comic, simply because in the grand context of what they were trying to do and what their abilities were, here's things that I thought they dropped the ball on. But Watchmen is a wonderful book, but, you know, you can say here's its faults. Then turn around and give two enthusiastic thumbs up to something like, the Stallone movie Expendables, which is just a silly bit of business from start to finish. But since they set out to do a silly bit of business from start to finish, well, you know, let's blow things up, shoot stuff, have fun, and, you know, kind of wrap it around a tenuous story, since that's exactly what they were trying for, it succeeds on every level. And see, that is the critical acumen that you have to do if you're going to, really give a good shot at being a reviewer. Still, like anything else in the internet age, anyone can be anything they want along those lines, and the cream will rise to the top. 90% of it is the crap that's spoken of, and that remaining 10%, some of it's pretty good. You just need to learn how to sift.
Well, and I think also just the ability, it's the same desire to get better at what you're doing no matter what.
Sure, and a track record. The good reviewers, you know, there are people I will listen to simply because they've reviewed enough stuff, my stuff and others, that I can see how their mind works. You know, they've explained themselves well. They're erudite, they're informative, and you will go back to them. You'll know that these are the ones that actually matter. And that's another way in which the good ones make themselves known. You know, after a while, you don't have to go searching out everything. You just search out the ones that matter. And then wince a little when they say you dropped the ball this time.
So now I'm interested in comic book advertising, because there's a comic book published by the smaller company called Comics Tribe called Scam, and they actually just put a billboard up in Las Vegas promoting their comic book.
Yep.
And so,
good for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I'm interested what your thoughts are on like that, and also just advertising for comics as a whole.
Well, advertising for comics as a whole hasn't really occurred. Part of that is because the old template is you need a publisher. And the best comic in the world is just one of what a publisher is doing. And a big publishing operation will have a marketing and advertising department, but they cannot do everything. So they tend to, we're going to focus on this and this and this and not this right now. They have marketing plans. The problem is if you're not part of the marketing plan, you know, you're SOL. The complication is that those marketing departments need to justify their existence. So the one thing they don't want, and this seems counterintuitive, but it's true, they don't want the creator on his own going out and advertising his book, because that's not part of our umbrella marketing plan. Don't you be a rogue angel. We're trying to get them to look at this, and you're over here waving your hand saying, look at this, and that's just not our plan. So that was always a problematic situation. But now you don't need to have the big companies. You can publish yourself, and there are so many ways to get stuff out there. People do trailers for books now, which kind of caught me by surprise, but now it's a phenomenon, and it's almost expected, because you can do it cheap and put it up on the internet and then get them out to people who just like clever stuff and will pass it along to people. The YouTube and internet and things like that, ability to pass the good, fun stuff along is a phenomenal force. There are some projects coming up. Now, I'm not doing commercials for Fables, because that's in DC's ballywhack and they've got their marketing plan, and I've benefited greatly from it. And they've even done commercials before, the BBC commercial. So they don't want me messing with that. But there's a few creator-owned small projects that are coming up that we're going to do commercials for, hopefully funny, hopefully entertaining enough to where it'll be passed around. And you can do those on a shoestring now. You can get software. Everyone with a computer now can make a movie or make a commercial or make, you know, whatever. And the only deciding factor on whether or not you can do it is, do you have the talent and the cleverness? Not do you have the budget and the resources. The budget and resources can be almost non-existent now. I love it. And people are being clever. They're doing commercials. They do trailers for books, and I would never have thought about that. And now it's almost becoming a standard. There are so many clever ideas for how to promote your comic or your whatever out there right now that we haven't seen yet, but that are just about to come out. And the nice thing is once those clever ideas come out, anyone else can take that idea and do one of theirs too. I love the age we're in for the ability to do what you can do to find your readers and get the knowledge out there. Or sometimes you do just an old style thing, like take out a whole billboard in the middle of a town, which no one thinks of doing. And, you know, I hope they didn't lose their shirt, or maybe the downturn in the Vegas economy made that viable. But good for them. I hope it pays off.
Well, they've actually done really well, because they've just signed with Diamond, and so there's lots of, they just did a Kickstarter campaign for one of the books. I mean, they've actually gotten a lot of good press, and they're moving it. And I just find it really impressive to see how like this really grassroots age can really give such a big push nowadays.
There's a story I told, and I don't remember who told it to me, so I'm going to say it's anecdotal. But I believe the source was pretty close to home when it was told. But when the first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles came out, and Laird and
Eastman,
thank you. Just two kids that, you know, did it in their basement or whatever, and put this book out on a shoestring and said, look, we made this book. And they sent copies of the first printing out to many people and say, this is great. What should we do with this? And at one of the lowest points of my career, I got one of these comp things. And so they were clearly sending it out to just like any name they could think of. Lowest point in the sense that no one really knew who I was and what I was doing. This is just before the Elementals broke out big. So they were clearly just sending it to anyone and saying, look at this book we made. Isn't this cool? And I looked at it and said, yeah, it's all right, but set it aside. But because they were two naive kids, and this is long before it became the phenomenon it eventually did, they didn't have anyone telling them the stuff they shouldn't do. And so they sent a review copy to the Wall Street Journal, which has never reviewed a comic. And the way the story was told to me is that some guy, Wall Street Journal, got this comic, said, no one's ever sent us a comic to review. What should we do? Do we even have a policy for this? His editor said, review it. And they got a review in the Wall Street Journal because they were too dumb to know that that is a waste of time and you shouldn't do it. I wonder how much ingenuity was squashed just because there was some expert on hand to tell them that, no, we do not. Come on. You don't send review copies to the Wall Street Journal. I think this is a time right now because of, you know, the internet and various ways to get stuff out there where you're going to have a lot of naive kids, doing stuff like that, and benefit, be blessed by the fact of not having an expert there to tell them that you just can't do that. I hope so, because I think that's where big strides and steps are really made. And I hope that story about the first issue of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is true. I believe it is. I trust whoever told me that.
Yeah, that is. That's a great story. So what comic books, then, would you say to people, you should read this, besides Fables and Ferrest and such?
Yeah, this is the question I hate most because, of course, 10 minutes after we hang up, I'm going to remember every single thing. I will pick up anything Mike Mignola does because I think he's just crazy genius in his storytelling.
Amazing screw on head.
Amazing screw on head. Who would make a character called Amazing Screw on Head? If there was an expert in the room, he would have said, Mike, don't do a character called Amazing Screw on Head. That's dumb. I'll pick up anything he does. I had a conversation in a comic shop once about how I would, if he did a history of foot fungus, I'd pick that book up. And the fellow said, I don't think I'd like a book about foot fungus. And I said, yeah, neither would I. What I'm saying is he is so good that you trust this guy that he would find a way into, yeah, but I wouldn't like a book about foot fungus. You're not getting my point. Anyway, Mike Mignola. There's certain artists, like Alan Davis that, I don't care if there's no story at all. His art is so elegant that I just want to see that wonderful world that he builds, play out in whatever way he cares to. In writers, you know, the wonderful thing about the whole mythic fiction movement, and now that we've kind of categorized that this is a movement and we have a name for it, is that when I run down the list of, like Kurt Busiek's Aerosmith, which was phenomenal, and Mouse Guard and Mice Templar, and Kill Shakespeare and the Stuff of Legends and the Unwritten and Memorial and stuff like that, it's like, that's a list of what I want to read. That's just my reading list. And I think you should try that. As a matter of fact, I think to answer that question, every single one of your listeners should come to FablesCon and tour the tables and see exactly the books that you should be reading.
No, I totally agree. So, how have your reading interests changed over the years?
Well, they've... All right, I'm going to tell you one more story. I hate to keep droning on.
I don't. Hate
There's
for
a
you
story. It's like a Buddhist koan, but it's basically about the peasant farmer who's just a guy digging in the dirt, keeping his garden outside of his peasant hut. And then a great satrap of the Chinese emperor comes along and sees that, you know, he has food there, or the peasant says some wise things that, you know, you're wasted here digging in the garden. You should come and to the capital and serve the emperor. And so he does. And, later on, he's an important official. And as he moves up the chain of wisdom and understanding, he becomes a more and more important official until one day he is the right hand of the emperor himself. And he is great and enlarged in wisdom. And then he becomes so wise that he begins to realize what's truly important in life. And so he ends his life as a simple farmer in a simple hut digging in his garden, because that's really what's important after all. And it's just that cycle of first it's naivete and now it's wisdom, but it gets you the same. My taste in reading was, as a kid, I wanted heroes. I wanted heroic heroes that are doing the right thing and right thing in very adverse conditions. I wanted definite characters with a code they adhered to. And I wanted struggle and overcoming struggle. I wanted the villains to be villainous. I wanted the heroes to be good. And occasionally, the cads in life come to some sort of realization where they found deep down inside them that there was a core of nobility to be found. Those were the stories I liked. Edgar Rice Burroughs and, action adventure-y, meaty, muscly, kind of stuff. True love. Later on, about the time I finally made it into comics and into superheroes, I was a little more sophisticated. And Elementals was a good example of, well, it's superheroes, but it's kind of nasty superheroes. They're grim, they're gritty, they're practical. They are earthy in the sense of They don't have high ideals. They have practical solutions to tough problems at best. Although I'm not unproud of the work I did with the Elementals, the idea that it just kind of helped push superheroes a little further into that kind of cynical area, I regret a little bit, because eventually I woke up and realized that that's not really what makes me happy as a writer and as a reader. John Byrne tells an anecdote that I think his friend Roger Stern said about the whole grim and gritty movement in superheroes, is that it's a result of the fact that most of the writers working now cannot conceive of anyone more noble than themselves. And maybe that's true. It's poignant, so maybe it's true. And maybe that's the problem. But since my tastes have come back to, you know, the guy in the garden again, it's like, no, you know, I've looked at cynical, dark, constantly fighting amongst ourselves, comic superhero characters, and I've dabbled in real heroes, and I like real heroes better. Both really do exist in the world. Part of it was just realizing, if you want to reflect the real world isn't just, you know, those nasty bastards that one runs into. Hopefully, other people run into really nice people from time to time. I think everyone really does know a quietly heroic person that'll give you the shirt off his back, even though it comes at some cost to him, that you really turn to when the chips are down. Almost anyone in any family knows the person they can turn to when it really gets grim and bad. So those people do still exist. You can reflect the real world and still tell stories of heroism and true nobility and valor, and people sticking to a bedrock core of their personal code. And my reading habits have kind of come back along that way. I still love a good nasty bastard sometimes, but as a general rule, give me the story about someone striving to be better than themselves. So anyway, did that cover the what I read or would like to read now?
Absolutely. So my last official question is going to be your sketch day that's coming up on Saturday.
2 days away.
2 days away. What's going on with that?
Well, I'm signed on to Twitter, and I was closing in slowly on 10,000 followers. I call them readers because followers sounds a little too cultish to me. And then I noticed that I was also closing in on having done 10,000 tweets, but a little less than the number of readers I have. And it kind of became important to me in some weird ways, like, because I started wondering, like, I wonder if I'll get to 9,000 readers before I get to 9,000 tweets. And I did, but barely. So then it was like, I wonder if I'll get to 9,500 readers before, and I did just barely. And then I was closing in on 10,000, which seems a milestone number. And the number of tweets was really, really closing in. It got within about 20 or so of the number of followers. And I did the math, and it's like, well, I do between, you know, 6 and 12 tweets a day, and I get between 3 or 4 followers a day. This is not gonna go well. I don't know why it became important that one number outdo another. But then I decided to throw that Hail Mary pass. I noticed that other people do things like bump up their follower count. So I decided, well, let's do something to convince people to add me as a reader. And it seemed it should be something of some value. Although, was it Scalzi that said if he got to a certain number that he would cover himself with cake frosting naked on Neil Gaiman's lawn?
I've seen some weird things, that's for sure.
He did it. He went, got naked on Neil Gaiman's lawn and covered himself with cake frosting. I'm not going to do that. One, because
he has
be a lot of frosting. But he has bees, yes. Yeah, I forgot about that. My neighbor has bees, too. So, yeah, that wouldn't be a good I decided not to do, like, a silly stunt, although that's a perfectly legitimate. I would like to see people do silly things from time to time. So I went for, well, let's do a stunt that that can kind of pay off in some way. I like supporting the Hero Initiative charity and like coming up with clever, fun ways to help them out. So I said, I tweeted, if I get to 10K readers before I get to 10K tweets, I will take a day off, spend that day sketching, which I seldom get to do, and then sell all those sketches on eBay or something like that and give the proceeds to Hero Initiative. And I did get 10K followers. The people retweeted that and got there pretty darn quick. So Saturday I will get up early in the morning or early-ish, sit down, start sketching right away. I've got a friend who's going to provide, you know, meals and things like that. He can't do bathroom breaks for me, but other than that, sketch all day until I go to bed. And however much is done, we'll sell and use the proceeds in a good cause. And Brad, my friend, will be live tweeting the stunt and also scanning the sketches as they're completed so that we can throw them out there and see that, you know, we're going to find out how fast I really can draw anymore. It's been so long since I've done an entire day of drawing. I suspect there will not be as many sketches as in my mind's eye I see already. But we'll see. And however many it is, that's what I'll do. And it's kind of a thank you to the folks that are, decent enough to follow, read my tweets. In one way or another, they'll at least have an opportunity to get a hold of one of those sketches or more and be serving a good cause by doing it.
Well, I love your art style and I tell you, I'm going to be following that like a dirty shirt.
Okay. Well, tell everyone to follow my friend Brad Tomte. I think his Twitter handle is @BradTomte, BradThomte.
So you didn't wind up replacing him as a friend from that moment to?
Oh, yeah. You know, no. If someday when I make a lot of money, I can afford a better friend than Brad. As it is, I'm kind of stuck with him. But someday I will indeed replace him for a better friend. Or at least a prettier one. You know, I'm shocked.
Perfect. So we're going to go on to the last words with Bill Willingham. So what are the last things you want to promote? Twitter account, et cetera, emails, blah, blah.
Okay. Promotion. I would like you to consider going to fablescon.com. That is the web address where you can find information about the Fabletown and Beyond convention coming up early next year. And for those of you that don't read Fables and the other books I do, I hope you'll be inspired by something we said tonight to consider that. For those of you that have and do and have been following along all the way, I want you to know that my appreciation that you're continuing to be there as a reader is undiminished. As a matter of fact, has grown. I really thank you folks and I will continue to spin the best lies and stories I can as we go along.
Brilliant. And then you're at Bill Willingham, no spaces, on Twitter?
Twitter, I'm at Bill Willingham, no spaces. I have a website that I think is BillWillingham.com.
I'm pretty sure it is.
And yeah, you can find your way from there.
Excellent. Well, Bill, I just want to thank you so much. You are an eloquent storyteller, and we appreciate you being on the show immensely. And I do look forward completely to actually being able to meet you in person.
All right. Well, thank you, Brett. And hunker down there in Calgary as winter comes along. And I hope you can make it. And if not, I'll meet you someday when I get to do the Calgary show again.
Excellent. Well, I try to go to as many shows as I possibly can make it to, and so eventually I'll find you.
All right. We'll see you, sir.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
All right. Bye bye.
Bye now. Once again, big thanks to Bill Willingham for being on the show. My name is Brett. That's Brett_WeTalk on Twitter. And then we got Brett@WeTalkPodcast.com. Of course, the other guys, we got Keith @CubReporterK. We got Chris_WeTalk. We got Mo_WeTalk. You can catch WeTalk Comics on the Comics Podcast Network. And otherwise, we are definitely OUT.